This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. When Joe Webster became an attorney, one of his first cases was a lawsuit he filed against his hometown of Madison, North Carolina. He successfully argued that it was wrong for the town to deny him, a black man, his own office space in a predominantly white neighborhood. That case continues to resonate with him today as a federal magistrate judge. He's often the first point of contact for people who are entering the American judicial system, and he describes his job as a delicate balance between dispensing justice and offering hope for offenders. But as he learned from his lawsuit against his own hometown, recognizing injustice is just as critical as his duty to deliver justice. Judge Joe Webster serves as Middle District of North Carolina. He serves in that district. He's been an attorney and a judge in this state for nearly 40 years and joins me now on the State of Things. Judge Joe Webster, welcome.
Thank you for having me here today, Frank.
Good to have you. Grew up in Madison, North Carolina. Describe your hometown for us, 50s and 60s, right?
Grew up, born in 1954, and lived there until I went away to Howard University 18 years later in 1972. Small town, two little small towns there together, Madison and Mayodan, and it was then a tobacco, they had a lot of tobacco warehouses and a lot of tobacco, a lot of textile mills and so forth, and so that's where I grew up.
You had a brief stint as a tobacco worker. Your parents got a farm.
Oh, yeah, they bought a farm in 1966, and I certainly know what tobacco gum is. I asked a young lady not long ago whether she knew what tobacco gum was, and she asked, was it something that you chew? And I says, not quite.
Now, what is it? Tell us.
Well, it's this gooey, gummy stuff that gets all over your hands and arms as you work in the tobacco field, harvesting tobacco. And so it's hard, grueling work in 90-plus degree weather. And
Too much exposure can expose you to nicotine poisoning as well, right?
Absolutely.
Make you sick, right?
I think my family, father, mother and father, thought I was malingering when I would sometimes get sick from working in tobacco, harvesting the tobacco, but it makes you violently ill. It can make you violently ill.
I think that's when your father, I understand, decided that you needed to go to school. Maybe the farm wasn't for you.
My parents were great people, even though they were not very educated. My father went to the fourth grade and my mother the 10th, but, you know, they were persons of faith, great faith, and hardworking persons, and upon sometimes getting sick, my father fortunately had mercy on me, and he would say, "Boy, you better go on to school," as I walked away, and so I thought I'd take him up on that.
That's kind of a curse and a blessing all in one.
All in one. That's absolutely right, Frank.
Well, talk about this, because these were the days of Jim Crow in the South. Your education was segregated. Tell us about your education.
All right. We didn't have kindergarten, at least not for African Americans. So 1960, I was in the first grade and went to Charles R. Drew High School, which was called, but it was grades 1 through 12. Hmm. And so for the very first 6 years of school, I attended Charles R. Drew High School. And I remember many, many great teachers. I remember my third grade teacher, who I actually went to visit. She just turned 90, and she used to tell us, you should not be reading like a square wheel bicycle. And so I've come to learn that that was kind of like a really slow and so forth. But I went to visit her in her home in Madison about a month ago. And she was doing well and just so pleased to see me.
High standards. I mean, you would get, sort of one off on miss one question on a test. And
well, I remember, I think it was perhaps the fourth grade. I remember getting the highest score in the class. We had a quiz that had five questions, so 20 points each. And so I missed one and made an 80, and that was the highest grade in the class. And Others made 60 or 40 or 20 or even zero. And she comes up to me and says, "Now, Joe, you know you can do better than that." And I, you know, felt badly, of course, but then it years later, I realized that she somehow saw promise in me and just knew that I needed to. We had a song in the church that I grew up in that said that 99 and a half won't do. And so I knew that I had to be almost perfect to get to where I needed to be.
Now, lest we think this is nostalgia for segregated education, that's not what you're saying.
No, I'm not. That, you know, was, there were some great things about that segregated education experience. And one was that the teachers lived in the community, and they knew our parents, and they would not hesitate to come make a visit if we were doing wrong. So I remember well one teacher taking one of my classmates, and this probably was the first, second grade, into the back to wash her up. You know, if that happened today, you probably have a suit on your hands. But this was just because she cared about that student. And all of our teachers cared about us tremendously back then. And So first through sixth grade, and then I remember in the sixth grade getting a piece of paper, which I now know to be a consent form, that allowed the student to consent to go to under freedom of choice, we called it back then. So I elected to go to what we called then the all-white school for my seventh and eighth grade year. I don't recall getting any advice from my parents about that, and frankly, still don't know today why I chose to do what I did, but I did, and I have these still have this very, very vivid memory of that first day of going to that school, of walking out our almost half mile roadway to the bus stop, and just kind of being nervous, not knowing what to expect, and remember getting on that bus and walking down the aisle, you know, not knowing whether someone was going to say something to me or whatever, but it was really uneventful, and I eventually found probably a seat to myself.
Well, you said you didn't get any advice on the choice, but did anybody warn you or suggest to you that it might be trouble?
I don't recall ever getting such advice, because if I had it, you know, who knows, I might not have taken that path.
But something, I mean, there was some sense of, I suppose anytime you change schools, especially if you're in sixth grade, there's a sense, some sense of dread, you're going into a new situation, right?
Yeah. I probably at that age didn't know enough about what it all meant and what the significance of it, of that was. And so I really can't say. No.
Well, you've talked about not feeling the full weight of segregation. I mean, even in the theaters and other aspects of civic life. I mean, talk about that, the sense that this is sort of just the way it was.
Yeah. Downtown Madison, we had a theater, as most most towns. And so black people had to go upstairs, and of course whites sat downstairs. And I was just not that long ago talking with one of my cousins, and was like, "Why didn't we do something about that?" And I guess just at that age, it was a sense of, well, this is just the way that it is, and so. We tolerated it, and we enjoyed the movies and went home.
So you said that your first day at school in that segregated school, the white school, was uneventful. What was the experience like after that for you?
It was, I think, a good experience. I was a good student for the most part. I mean, I really didn't have any, I can't remember any situation that I would consider to have been you know, anything happening to me that might have been racially motivated. Everybody was friendly. And, you know, I know that there are other towns across the state of North Carolina that had different situations than I've had, but it was an enjoyable experience for the most part.
You were 14 years old when Dr. King was shot and killed in 1968, Robert Kennedy killed a few months later. How do you remember those tragedies and your response?
Oh, man, I remember, I think I was, and I might be wrong about this, but it might have been like a Thursday evening or night, and I might have been watching Daniel Boone, one of my favorite shows back then, and seeing the, you know, I mean, the interruption and just being, even at that age, I knew that that was serious. I knew that it was, I guess I felt like, because we had lost John Kennedy, President Kennedy, and 5 years earlier in 1963. And then, of course, that same year in 1968, we lost Robert Kennedy. And, I remember working in the tobacco back then and just kind of thinking to myself, what is this? I mean, what is happening in America where all of the, seemingly all of the good people, those who want to, who believe in fairness and justice and who want equality, who are being gunned down and shot and killed. So it was a sad time.
I'm talking with Judge Joe Webster today on the state of things, a judge for the Middle District, federal judge for the Middle District of North Carolina, and our conversation will continue in a moment. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. My guest this hour is Judge Joe Webster, a native of Madison, North Carolina, a federal magistrate judge for North Carolina's Middle District. We're talking about things that may have your education early on. You decided to go to Howard University for college. What made you decide to leave the state?
Well, I had read about persons such as really giants such as Thurgood Marshall and others who had done so much. He was the lead attorney in Brown versus Board of Education that was the Supreme Court ruled in 1954 that separate but equal was unconstitutional in the educational setting. And I knew enough about Howard at the time that many great persons had been there, and some of, you know, most of the great African-American doctors and lawyers in those early days had gone to Howard. And so that's, I think, what really took me there.
Had you decided by then to become a lawyer?
I decided that I wanted to become a lawyer probably in the 9th or 10th grade.
And again, was it social justice that pushed you in that direction, or were you thinking something else when you were in 9th or 10th grade?
You know, in at that time in my life, I knew that there was probably, first of all, I'd never met a lawyer until I was in college. The only lawyer that I knew about was Perry Mason, and he wasn't a real lawyer. So I think there are probably a lot of things that contributed to me wanting to become a lawyer, but I just know that, you know, what basically we had were black preachers and black teachers and principals, and nobody really that I knew went beyond that, and so I felt that I could make a difference by being a lawyer.
You applied, you finished undergrad and then applied to Duke Law School, right?
That's correct.
Didn't get in.
I didn't get in, that's been 40 years ago. So I did, you know, get into Howard. And, you know, I met, as a result of staying at Howard, I met Thurgood Marshall, because he came to Howard in 1978, to when we dedicated our new moot court. And so probably if we'd gotten into Duke, I never would have met him.
Well, you did get in eventually. You just recently finished your LLM, right?
That's right. Great, great program. There's Duke has a program for judges, and I had the great privilege, and I really appreciate that Duke allowed me in to witness that. Great teachers there.
Yeah.
Great dean, And one of the great things about it is I met 18 or 19 other judges from around the state, actually around the country, and actually one from Germany and one from Jamaica. So I have all these new friends now as a result of that.
We went to Howard for law school, and while you were there, this was the landmark affirmative action case. Of course, the Bakke case had made its way through the courts.
Yeah.
Tell us what you remember about that decision.
Well, I remember that decision coming down in late June of 1978. Actually, I was working for what was then called the Civil Service Commission, and I remember my boss having me to go over to the Supreme Court and to get a copy of it. And, the Bakke decision was Mr. Bakke, who had been denied admission to graduate school, or maybe it was law school at
UC Davis, right?
Yeah, UC Davis. And so the Supreme Court said he should have been admitted, that the fact that the University of California system was using racial quotas as a part of its affirmative action program.
And he's white. Bakke's white.
Bakke's
he wanted to get into
right.
med
that's,
school,
that's,
UC
that's,
Davis
that's,
med school.
That's,
yeah,
that's correct. So anyway.
And an interesting decision, right, because it upheld the idea of affirmative action, but it criticized what it threw out was the quota system.
That's correct. And, you know, back then, you know, everybody realized that there was still need for some affirmative action, as much affirmative action as one could have in some of these institutions. And so I along with other students at Howard, I remember marching from the main campus, and this was my last year of law school, marching down to the Supreme Court to protest that decision.
You decided to, so you go to law school, you've left, you're going to school at Howard, and then you decided you wanted to move back to Madison.
Well, I think, as I've thought about it over the years, and even before moving back there, I mean, I felt like I almost had no choice. In its almost now 200-year history, I'm the first and only African-American lawyer that has ever practiced law there. And so I just felt this tug, this notion that I had to go back home to practice law. And so that's the reason that I did that. It's interesting that I had I went in mid-August of 1980 when I hung my shingle there, and I just got married on May 3rd, the previous May 3rd. And, you know, I look back on that and, I guess, too young and foolish to know just how stressful that would be on a new marriage. And so I am absolutely certain that my wife, Diane, is so pleased that I'm doing something with a regular paycheck right now.
Well, because for a while you were renting, right? You're renting some leasing office space. Right?
That's right.
So tell us about your decision to buy a place on this kind of professional road.
Yeah. I'd been renting since mid-August of 1980, and you know, it was kind of like I felt like I'd outgrown the space, and that you know, I could, if I bought a place, it would be my own, and so forth. And so I think that was the reason that I decided to try to buy a space. And so I started looking around and saw this house on that main highway. Actually, it was the same street in which where my original office was located, just down the street a piece from it. And so it, you know, needed a little bit of work, but it was a beautiful two-story house. I don't know when it was built, but probably the 20s or 30s. And so that's what we decided to do. But, you know, it was quite a challenge, because first of all, I had to get a loan, and I was applied with a local, I don't know if it was a savings and loan or a bank there in town, and they denied me. They said, what if the Board of Adjustment doesn't approve, you know, you're using it as your law office? And so I was denied a loan and had to go to Greensboro, which was fortunately had, I think, a couple of black-owned banks there, and so they immediately approved my loan, purchased the house, went before the board of adjustment, and told them exactly what I planned to use it for, and I was denied the right to use it.
So it was a zoning problem, right?
It was zoning. Well, it was zoned such that one could have an office there.
I see.
And in fact, across the street was a white-owned dentist. Up the street was a realtor's office, a doctor's office. And so, you know, there was plenty of precedent for what I was trying to do. And so I really don't know. The Superior Court judge, I believe, said that it was arbitrary and capricious, and so he sent it back to the board to make a decision. And
well, that happened because you filed suit.
I think so.
Yes, I mean, the judges don't really offer those kind of opinions unless somebody asks
right.
them.
Yeah.
So, but tell us about that decision. Again, this is interesting. The bank is prescient in deciding that even though the dentist got the loan and the real estate office got the loan and everybody else got approval from this board of adjusters, you just might not, they thought. That was real kind of clairvoyance in there.
I certainly, as far as I know, the dentist and the doctor and the realtor, they may have paid cash for theirs. I don't know. But
anyway, they got permission.
They got permission from the local zoning place. And, you know, the thing is, people have asked me, well, do you think was that racial? Or was that racially motivated? I mean, if you looked at the facts of it on the ground, that's what it looked like. But the thing is, it was a situation of unfairness. And I think a lot of people feel that if something is not racially motivated, then one is not affected. But I can just tell you that it was more about the unfairness of it that really aided me. And it, frankly, I think it caused my wife to just kind of dislike the area where we were living. I lost sleep. I probably lost weight. But I knew that as the black lawyer, that I could not just sit still and allow that to stand. I knew that if I failed, then the other persons that had no voice would certainly fail as well. So I felt like I had to fight the town to get my right to have to use the building of the house that I had purchased, just like the others had done.
So. But think about this now. This is 1984, by the way.
When you have 1984.
This is after Bakke. So if anybody wondered if the racial discrimination still plays a part in everyday life of America, yes, in 1984, and we could go beyond that, but that's the facts leave us in 84. Think about all of the decisions, the federal policy beginning in the 1930s of not lending money to African-American families for houses and all the wealth that didn't get built and all the banks that were complicit in redlining. I mean, this is serious business for millions and millions of families who cannot build wealth and now are here generations later sort of enduring that legacy. And I think this is perhaps what people miss when we try to understand the legacy of racism and why, if anyone would argue, we're not living in a post-racial America.
That's true, and again, this has been a long time ago, but in some ways it still stays with me today, but not to the point at all of being bitter. I've long since put that behind me, and plus I know that, if you stay bitter about things, and you will just almost be to the point of being sick yourself. But I just would encourage people to treat people fairly. It's not that hard. It's not that hard to be fair and treat people fairly in all that you do.
Well, it's interesting to think about your position now as a judge, given your experience, the idea that you don't have to necessarily take race into account, but just ask that question, is this fair? you could allow you to come to a fair conclusion.
That's correct. I try to be fair in every case. You know, some people, including probably some African Americans, will almost want kind of like favoritism. Mm-hmm. You know, because we were treated this way right. back in the, you know, way back up until sometimes even now. But you know, the thing is that we, as myself as and others as judges, we will be as bad as those who treated us so badly back in the years if we don't treat everybody with fairness and respect now.
Well, tell us about your decision to jump from attorney to judge.
Yeah, you know, I never wanted to be a judge. I mean, until more recent years, all I ever wanted to do was to practice law and be a voice for those who could not speak for themselves. And so I just started doing my job, hung my shingle, and started doing my work, my job. And that has not, and I did that for many years. This is my, I guess, 37th year of being in the legal profession. And there were many, many times when there were very lean times. I tell people sometimes that my wife accuses me of having worked for Polk Salad. Probably not many of your city reader listeners would know what Polk Salad is, but it's a kind of a almost like salad greens or some, but it grows wild along the side of the road or in so forth. And one time a client, I came home one day and told my wife that, and my children at the dinner table, that Miss Beasley had brought me some Polk Salad and a piece of cornbread and a piece of pork or meat of some sort. And my wife said to my to the children, she said, "Lord, children, your dad's client's paying him with Polk Salad." And so, you know, it really wasn't pay. She just thought I'd done a good job and knew that I liked it.
But now that you're in this position as magistrate, you see people come before you, and the idea that people, I mean, that often they're facing a well-oiled legal machine without much in the way of legal help themselves.
That's correct. I would be misleading you if I didn't say that still affects me greatly today. We have in our criminal system, if one is not able to afford a lawyer, and you could possibly get a criminal sentence or prison sentence, then you are entitled to a lawyer. But we don't have an equivalent for our civil system. And so one of the, I remember just so many times, and even now as a federal judge, I'll see on one side two very good seasoned lawyers, and on the other side you'll have a little old lady or a man or somebody trying to plead their case without the benefit of a lawyer. And sometimes, I'll ask myself, well, how could this possibly be fair? And, you know, the problem is that it is a system designed for well-educated lawyers and judges who know the rules of civil procedure, who know the rules of evidence, who know the local rules. And on the other side, you have someone who maybe it's the first time they've ever been to court. And so you see them trying to plead their case, and if they're examining witnesses, quite often there's an objection, and you know, the judge often has to sustain the objection because what happens is that the unrepresented person is really arguing with the witness rather than asking questions.
What's at stake? Give us a sense in a civil case like this, what might be at stake for these people?
Well, it could be thousands and thousands of dollars. It could be their home. Yeah. It could be many, many things. But it may be their job. We get all kinds of cases in the federal and state system.
But this is crucial because we're talking about wealth building. We're talking about some foundation on which you could build and perhaps then a future for your children, et cetera. It can all be lost because, again, of this imbalance, this asymmetry. But how do you do that? You've got your own personal history, your sense of justice, and you have to be fair. You have to, you know, follow the rules of jurisprudence. How does that affect you? What do you do at the bench?
Yeah, you know, one of my law clerks just asked me the other day. He said, "Does it bother you that you have to follow the law? You know, in situations where it just doesn't seem fair." You know, bothers. That may not be the right word, but sometimes you are troubled by the fact that we have a system as we have, and I just tell you, I was studying at Duke, and I began to just think that maybe we need a new kind of court system for our pro se litigants, someone where you don't have to know the rules of evidence, or where you don't have to know the rules of civil procedure, because after all, the word verdict means to speak the truth. So maybe we need to be rethinking what it means to speak the truth and how we go about determining what the truth is.
I am speaking with Judge Joe Webster today, federal magistrate judge for the Middle District of North Carolina, and we will continue our conversation after this. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking this hour with Judge Joe Webster, serves as a federal magistrate judge for the Middle District of North Carolina, spent nearly 40 years as an attorney and a judge in this state. So I've been saying this, federal magistrate judge. Tell me what that role is. What is your role?
My role is to, in criminal cases, we do magistrate judging. There are three of us in the Middle District in Winston-Salem, Greensboro, and I'm stationed in Durham. But we do the initial appearances. We're the first judicial official that someone charged with a federal crime sees, and so it's important for us to, in a way, get off on a good start and treat them fairly with respect and so forth. And I always try to keep that in mind. And then we do if the defendant wants what we call a detention hearing. To determine whether they'll get out of jail pending trial or further proceedings in the case. We do those where we have witnesses, sworn witnesses, and so forth. And then we, you know, make a decision about whether to get out. We also do we do other proceedings and so forth.
You do rotations, right?
We do rotations every third month. I'm on criminal duty.
Do a month of that, and then 3 months of civil?
Well, you know, actually, like even when we're on criminal duty, we're still doing civil cases because we do mostly civil cases. We also do search warrants. Federal officials will come to us to get a search warrant to search your home, your car, your computer, of what have you. So that's also a big part of what we do.
Well, I guess I want to come back to this question we asked just before the break and see how it applies in this case. Here you have a young man or a young woman standing before you. It may be their first charge. It happens to be now a federal charge. It may be a gun or a drug charge, and that's why it's a federal. They're facing a fair amount of prison time. You're looking at them. You have a sense that this is a human being with a future who may well have committed a serious crime. Again, how do you approach this sense? This is their initial contact with our criminal justice system.
Well, first of all, there are laws that govern what we can and we cannot do. I'm bound by the laws that govern whether or not your person should get out of jail. Mm-hmm. If that person is, I have to look at whether or not they are a danger to the community, or whether or not, you know, whether it really comes down to whether or not you believe that they will come back to court. And so we have to look at that. And we can also look at whether they have a third-party custodian that might allay any fears that you might have, whether that they will appear in court or not, so or that they would be a danger to the community. So, you know, we see so much, so many cases involving persons who are charged with drug offenses, mostly cocaine and marijuana. And we see a number of other very serious bank robbery and at that initial stage and other kinds of crimes. And so you kind of try to look at the totality of circumstances, and so you just, it's sometimes very difficult to make a decision.
Well, again, and I wonder when you step back and you see as a big picture, what's going on. I mean, last year's New York Times piece about the 1.5 million black men missing, many of whom missing because of mass incarceration. Again, that's something you have to know in the back of your mind, and you've got the day-to-day responsibilities governed by some very strict laws. How do you manage those?
Sometimes it's difficult. I certainly realize, as a person of the community, that there are many communities across this state and nation where most of the black men are in prison. And so what does that do? That means that that it's mostly run by, and that it is mostly young men, and most of who I see are young black males, many of whom have all but given up on life. And I have seen many who have, a lot of them have a lot of children, and so they're young men who, yesterday we celebrated, some of us, Father's Day, and there's just so many who not only are their fathers either in prison or dead, but there are many who say that they don't know who their fathers are. So if you could really think about what effect that would have on a person's mentality, I mean, it would. So,
well, I wonder if you can even afford the luxury of looking at the big picture and then analyze it. Is this because these statistics that we see, is this mass incarceration the result of individual bad decisions on everyone's part, or is there something in our system that needs examining when you take a look at who's in jail and who's not?
I'm sure there's a number of reasons, but you know, I believe that there are probably many young folk who, it's almost like they don't know right from wrong, and that's not something that is inherent to you. You have to be taught it. And if you don't have a father, mother, at home, and there's just so many issues. In fact, we started a program shortly after I came to Durham called Court Cares, and we bring in middle school students. In a sense, it's a partnership with Durham Public Schools, mm-hmm. and they each month we bring in another different middle school, and we have a guest speaker. We've had Mayor Bill Bale there. We've had airline pilots. We had Bucky Waters, who was a former coach at Duke University's basketball team. We've had convicted felon, just any number of people. But we also have a criminal trial in which the students act as jurors. And I remember one instance, for example, we had a retired black general speaking to the group, and he was really encouraging them that they could be great. And one probably 7th or 8th grade young lady said, "I can't be great because I was a mistake." And my heart just, just fell. I mean, and then I was thinking to myself, what kind of mother or father or grandparent or guardian would instill in that young lady that she couldn't be great? And so I guess I've almost decided in my mind that, you know, the lack of good parents and so forth is a big reason that we have a lot of this crime. And I, anyway, the general just started speaking to her directly. Mm. And so we have a big job.
Well, I wonder what you think about the pressure on some of these parents and some of these families, especially low-wealth families, who, as we say, you know, they've been systematically denied the right to build wealth going back generations. Okay, now they're here. Chief District Judge, State Judge Marsha Morey, Chief District Judge in Durham, has said that, in a nutshell, jail has become punishment for poverty. She talks about the fact that the legislature has increased court fees. If you didn't pay a traffic fine, you lose your license. Then there's court fees. If you can't pay that, we're going to send you to jail where you can't go to your job because you don't have a... And she writes about this eloquently, saying that... And if she tries to waive the court fees, this legislature is now asking for a report from all district judges on who's waiving fees. So, again, the pressure on poor people... seems to be fairly intense, and I wonder, you know, what you think about that. I mean, we all have to obey the law. We have to all have to pay our fines, but you can imagine down at that level how difficult it is to get out of that mess.
Yeah, that you raise a big issue with, you know, just this poverty. Poverty probably more, even more so than racism is such a big problem here. And, you know, obviously I admire that district judge who has the courage to do what she thinks is right. And I think we need to just, as I said, maybe said earlier, just kind of rethink our judicial system, and because it is not working like it ought to work. Today, when you have a situation like that, where if somebody doesn't have a job, obviously they can't pay a fine. I mean, so if they end up going to jail for that,
I mean, it's debtor's prison.
It makes no sense.
You've also said poverty is clearly a problem, and mental illness is now increasingly a problem.
Oh my goodness. You know, one of the great problems with, you know, a lot of the persons who are charged have a mental illness, and rather than send them to a place where they can get treatment and medicine and so forth, we're putting them in jail. And also one problem here in America and perhaps other places is this concept of the stigma that goes along with mental illness. Somehow or another, we as a society need to work on that, to be more open with dealing with mental illness. I mean, I would, and it's just a guess, but I would say if your family is large enough that most of us have had someone in the family with mental illness, and we've thought about, we've been fair enough in this society, is that we don't treat, or generally have not treated people who kill somebody and is mentally ill. We generally have not found that they ought to go to prison, you know. But somehow or another, we need to work on being more open.
We're cutting back, too, not only the stigma, but we're cutting back on treatment and the ability to pay for mental illness. And so now our courts, our police, and our jails are becoming the de facto asylums in the 21st century.
Now you've raised a big problem that needs to be worked on as well.
So what do you think are the, if you talk about reform, where do you think we should start? And kind of if you had the ability to sort of wave a magic wand, what would it look like?
If I could wave a magic wand, I would have more, I could see more community involvement in our courts, and especially our criminal courts. I see so many young men that, you know, who have had no direction, especially by a man or father and so forth. And so I guess I found that, you know, if you show people love, that will go further than anything that we could possibly ever do. And so if we could have more mentors, more people, more men come into court and perhaps having some conversation to show that person that someone cares about them. I sense that many people today don't believe that anybody cares about them. And so they, you know, many think that they're not going to live long anyway. And so it's a sad sort of situation. And I would not, obviously can't, you know, my mind doesn't allow me to think completely about how we could structure this, but we need to have some other way to deal with pro se litigants than we have today.
This would be litigants who people in court need legal help.
Right, who can't afford
a lawyer. What about, you talked about more community involvement, and what you talked about was mentorship, so people sort of reaching out into the community. But we found that many communities, particularly low-wealth communities, have a suspicious, not a particularly good relationship with the courts and the police. How do we rebuild some of the trust that has been lost, particularly in recent years, in order to get that kind of engagement to begin?
That's tough. I was just listening to her on television the other day about, I believe it was in, I don't know whether it was in Oakland or one of the cities that where police were having sexual relations
with Oakland,
yeah. California. And I mean, you know, that what,
right.
it saddens you. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things is that, like teachers, we're not paying them enough, and so we end up with in the case of police officers, with probably many persons who probably shouldn't even be police officers and are not getting our best and brightest, which is a very difficult job that they have. And so you know, we need to think about that as well.
Judge Webster, a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Frank, for having me here.
Judge Joe Webster is a federal magistrate judge in the Middle District for North Carolina. You can find out more about our show at our website, stateofthings.org. Tomorrow we're going to talk about the case of Wildon Acosta. He is still in federal custody. He's at a detention center. There have been questions about whether or not he's been held in solitary confinement. We'll talk about his confinement and then step back a little bit and talk about detention centers, particularly privately owned detention centers, when it comes to immigration. That's tomorrow on The State of Things. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Will Michaels, and Charlie Shelton Ormond. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Wadarski is sitting in today. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.